Good morning, Church of God. Today we're in the middle of a four-part series, a spiritual roadmap that will help guide us through 2013. A couple weeks ago we talked about King Asa and how he did what was right and pleasing in God's sight. Last week we talked about making God's house a house of prayer for all nations. And today we talk about restoration. Today we turn once again to Israel in the Old Testament times. Paul writes to us, "Now all these things happened to them," speaking of the Jews, "as examples, in that they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come." That's us. Well, at the time of the prophet Ezekiel, the people of Israel are in captivity to Babylon. They've been taken away from their homes, away from their land, and they're being held captive as servants in the land of Babylon. And Israel's enemies moved into the land of Israel and settled in their land. It seemed to be a sad ending for a people who started out with such high hopes. God meant for Israel to be a light unto the world, and now, through their own indulgence in sin and idolatry, they had brought the nation to utter ruin. They had lost their land, their homes, and even their freedom. All hope is seemingly lost. But at that moment of utter despair, God came to Ezekiel with a most intriguing message. I call this message, "When God Spoke to the Mountains." Let's read it in Ezekiel 36. Starting in verse 1, "Son of man, prophesy to Israel's mountains. Give them this message. O mountains of Israel, hear the word of Yahweh. This is what the sovereign Yahweh says. Your enemies have taunted you, saying, 'Aha, now the ancient heights belong to us.' Therefore, son of man, give the mountains of Israel this message from the sovereign Yahweh. Your enemies have attacked you from all directions, making you the property of many nations and the object of much mocking and slander. Therefore, O mountains of Israel, hear the word of the sovereign Yahweh. He speaks to the hills and mountains, ravines and valleys, and to ruined wastes and long deserted cities that have been destroyed and mocked by the surrounding nations." So here we have enemies that have occupied the land promised to God's people. Yahweh says, "Your enemies have attacked you from all directions." Have you ever felt like the enemy was assaulting you from all directions? Every direction you turn, an enemy is coming at you. That's how it was for Israel. And if you drop your guard, even for an instant, if you neglect to put on the full armor of God, if you give in to temptation, to sin, to break his commandments, the enemy will move in. And the enemy will stake a claim to the territory of your heart. And he will build fortresses and strongholds in the land that should belong to the Lord. The enemy will find your weakness. He will discover the gap in your wall. And he will exploit that weakness. And if you fail to overcome that weakness, the armies of darkness will pour in through that gap in your soul. Until eventually they will conquer your entire land, your entire soul. All it takes is one gap in the defenses. One gap in the wall and the enemy will move in. A city may have 200-foot walls surrounding it on all sides, but if it has one gap, even just a few feet, large enough for an enemy soldier to slip through, then the entire city is destined to fall. Judas had a gap in his wall. Judas was chosen by Jesus, chosen to be the leader, a leader of the Church of God. He walked daily with Jesus, listened to his teachings. He was sent out, performing miracles, casting out demons, healing the sick. And despite all he had going for him, Judas had a gap in his wall. He was greedy. He was willing to break Father's commandments, stealing to satisfy his greed. And Judas never allowed Father to repair that gap in his wall. And Satan exploited Judas's greediness, offering him money to betray Messiah. And at the end of Judas' life, we find Satan moving into his heart and taking full control. You see, one gap in the wall is all the enemy needs to move into our hearts and set up strongholds. And if we do not close that gap, we are destined to be defeated, ruined, and enslaved. And that's exactly what happened to Israel. We read in history that Israel was caught up in idolatrous pagan practices. and their persistence in evil doing drove away the presence and protection of God. And so Israel's enemies entered in and conquered her, and then they mocked Israel and Israel's God. The enemy loves to mock God when God's children fail. And so Yahweh speaks to the mountains, continuing on in verse 6. Therefore prophesy to the hills and mountains, the ravines and valleys of Israel. This is what the sovereign Yahweh says. I am furious that you have suffered shame before the surrounding nations. Therefore, this is what the sovereign Yahweh says. I have taken a solemn oath that those nations will soon have their own shame to endure. But the mountains of Israel will produce heavy crops of fruit for my people, for they will be coming home soon. See, I care about you, and I will pay attention to you. Your ground will be plowed and your crops planted. I will greatly increase the population of Israel, and the ruined cities will be rebuilt and be filled with people. I will increase not only the people, but also the animals. O mountains of Israel, I will bring people to live on you once again. I will make you even more prosperous than you were before. Then you will know that I am Yahweh. I will cause my people to walk on you once again, and you will be their territory. Well, perhaps you've been defeated by the enemy today. You gave in to sin. You fell to temptation. And the enemy has been beating you over the head with your failure. The devil tells you that you're done. You can't do anything more for God in this life. You're ruined and you're good for nothing. The devil tells you that God's written you off. He's done with you. You might as well curse God and die. Well, I've got good news for you today. No matter how far you've been beaten down by life, beaten down by the devil, there's always hope. Yahweh says, see, I care about you. You will once more bear fruit. Your ruins will be rebuilt. You see, he is the God of restoration. He is the God of another chance. He is the God that speaks to mountains. Verse 25. Then I will sprinkle clean water on you, and you will be clean. Your filth will be washed away, and you will no longer worship idols. The first step today in restoration is forgiveness. Only God can forgive us and cleanse us from the filth of sin in our lives. David, after his great sin, wrote in Psalm 51, "Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin." If we confess our sins, by God's grace, we are cleansed from the guilt, the stain of sin. We are accepted in the Beloved, not because of anything we did, but on the basis that Jesus paid the penalty for our sins. Verse 26, "And I will give you a new heart, and I will put a new spirit in you, and I will take out your stony, stubborn heart and give you a tender, responsive heart." The second step of restoration is a new heart. Have you ever known anyone that performed heart surgery upon themselves? "Oh, I'm having a few chest pains, so I think I'll go in the kitchen and grab the kitchen knife and cut my chest open and repair my heart. Think of all the money I'll save on hospital bills." It's ridiculous to think we can perform our own heart surgery. And yet we find some thinking that they can perform their own spiritual heart surgery. They think that by trying harder, buckling down, gritting their teeth, working up just a little more willpower, they'll be able to cleanse their heart. But we can no more fix our heart than we can perform heart surgery upon ourselves. It's not about willpower, it's about God power. A new heart is a gift, and this new heart has brand new desires. It no longer desires the things of the world. It no longer is cold toward God. It's tender, sensitive toward God, sensitive to the needs of others. It's open on the Godward side. It desires one thing and one thing alone, to worship, to serve, to honor God. You can't work that up by trying to be good, trying to be better. It's not a behavior that you can learn. It's a complete transformation. And if you want a new heart today, you need to go to the heart surgeon, Dr. Jesus. Verse 27. "And I will put my spirit in you, so that you will follow my decrees and be careful to obey my regulations. The third step in restoration is the infilling of the Holy Spirit. Notice the cause and effect are clearly spelled out in this verse. First, God places His Spirit in you. That's the cause. And the effect, the outcome, is obedience to God's law. Paul wrote in Romans 8:4, that the righteousness of the law might be fulfilled in us, who walk not after the flesh, but after the Spirit. We don't earn our salvation by obedience. We are accepted in the Beloved even before we obey. Obedience is the effect, the result of walking in the Spirit. When we're filled with the Spirit produces obedience in our lives. Paul says the righteousness of the law will be fulfilled in us who walk after the Spirit. Now continuing on in Ezekiel chapter 36, verse 29, I will cleanse you of your filthy behavior. I will give you good crops of grain, and I will send no more famines on the land. I will give you great harvests from your fruit trees and fields. The fourth step in restoration is bearing fruit. God says He will cleanse our filthy behavior. Once we as a people are cleansed, the harvest will come in. When Jesus can be clearly seen in us, in this church, the harvest will come in. Jesus said, I am the vine, you are the branches. He who abides in me and I in him, he bears much fruit. For apart from me, you can do nothing. My Father is glorified by this, that you bear much fruit and so prove to be my disciples. The proof, then, of being a disciple of Jesus is that you will bear fruit. When you abide in Jesus, you will bear fruit. You cannot help but bear fruit. You see, the branch does not have to labor to bear fruit. The branch automatically produces fruit so long as it's connected to the vine. Therefore, our primary effort in this life is not to bear fruit. Our primary effort is to abide in Jesus. That's the secret of bearing much fruit. But you say, Elder Anderson, that's so abstract. How do you abide in someone you can't even see? I'll answer that with a real-life example. The day starts off first thing in the morning with prayer and Bible reading. As you read the Bible, you hide the Word in your heart. Then throughout the day as you work, you meditate on that Word. And you pray throughout the day like Daniel did. And whenever the church doors are open, you gather with the saints for worship. Finally, you ask Father to assign you work in His kingdom, and you participate in doing the work of the Lord. These are the five ways you abide in Jesus. 1. Bible study. 2. Prayer. 3. Meditation on the Word. 4. Worship with the saints. 5. Laboring with Jesus. If you neglect any of these, you weaken yourself spiritually. This is the essence, the discipline of the Christian life. It's not a legalistic formula. This is how to build a relationship with Jesus. It takes time and effort to build a relationship. And if you want to bear much fruit, you must choose to invest the time and the effort. Continuing on in verse 31. Then you will remember your past sins and despise yourselves for all the detestable things you did. But remember, says the sovereign Yahweh, I am not doing this because you deserve it. Oh, my people of Israel, you should be utterly ashamed of all you have done. The fifth step, then, is humility. After you've been restored, you'll look back on your prior life and you'll be disgusted, ashamed. You'll say, how could I do such despicable things? But we're not to dwell on the past, except to remind us of how weak we are in the flesh and what we're capable of, so that we'll be humble and remember, but for the grace of God, I would be lost. So that we'll never cast stones at someone else. So that we will not participate in the ministry of condemnation. You know, we need to be perpetually on our guard against spiritual pride. Our greatest need is grace, but grace is only given to the undeserving, to the humble. Peter wrote, be clothed with humility, for God resisteth the proud and giveth grace to the humble. Watch Jesus. He was full of grace, overflowing with grace. And yet, who are the recipients of that grace? prostitutes, the demon-possessed, lepers, the tax collectors, the thieves, the outcasts of society, the riffraff, the lowlife. Why? Because they were open on the Godward side. They recognized they were undeserving of God's favor. The publican said, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. God's favor is always unmerited. It's always undeserved. That's why they call it amazing grace. We should never get puffed up into thinking we're something all that great. If there's any good in us, it's there by the grace of God. If it wasn't for his grace, we have no idea how low we could sink. The Pharisees thought they were something great. They obeyed all the laws and even added a ton of laws on top of the law. They fasted twice a week. They prayed loudly on the street corner. They attended synagogue regularly and took the best seats. They kept the Sabbath to perfection. They rigorously performed the ceremonial washings. They even tithed of the little herb plants in their gardens, and yet they ended up murdering the Messiah, the Creator, the most horrific crime in the history of the universe. You see, you can do all the right things for all the wrong reasons. Spiritual pride is a deadly disease. Continuing in verse 33. This is what the Sovereign Yahweh says, when I cleanse you from your sins, I will repopulate your cities, and the ruins will be rebuilt. The fields that used to lie empty and desolate in plain view of everyone will be farmed. And when I bring you back, people will say, this former wasteland is now like the Garden of Eden. The abandoned ruined cities now have strong walls and are filled with people. Then the surrounding nations that survive will know that I, Yahweh, have rebuilt the ruins and replanted the wasteland. For I, Yahweh, have spoken, and I will do what I say. This is what the Sovereign Yahweh says. I am ready to hear Israel's prayers. You know, prior to the Babylonian captivity, at the time when Babylon invaded Israel, I'm sure many Hebrews called out to God in prayer. However, at that time, he wasn't ready to hear their prayers. Why? Because they weren't ready to receive his blessings. They had to learn a lesson in obedience and humility. The psalmist wrote, if I had cherished sin in my heart, the Lord would not have listened. We can pray from now until kingdom comes, and it won't have any effect if we cherish sin in our hearts. In Isaiah 58, I love the way the author of the Message Bible entitled this chapter. He entitled it, Your Prayers Won't Get Off the Ground. Let's read it, starting in verse 2. They're busy, busy, busy at worship and love studying all the time. To all appearances, they're a nation of right-living people, law-abiding, God-honoring. They ask me, what's the right thing to do? And love having me on their side. But they also complain. Why do we fast and you don't look our way? Why do we humble ourselves and you don't even notice? Well, here's why. The bottom line on your fast days is profit. You drive your employees much too hard. You fast, but at the same time you bicker and fight. You fast, but you swing a mean fist. The kind of fasting you do won't get your prayers off the ground. Do you think this is the kind of fast day I'm after? A day to show off humility? To put on a pious long face and parade around solemnly in black? You call that fasting? A fast day that I, God, would like? How many of you know that if you mistreat your employees, your prayers won't get off the ground? How many of you know that if you bicker and fight, or as the King James Version says, strife and debate, or as the NIV says, quarreling, your prayers won't get off the ground? Quarreling with your spouse, fighting with people at work, bickering with your parents, debating with other church folk, your prayers won't get off the ground. Strife is not the way of Yahweh. If you're quarreling with people, always think that you're right and they're wrong, and making sure the other person knows that they're wrong, your prayers aren't going anywhere. Continuing on in Isaiah 58 with verse 6. This is the kind of fasting I'm after, to break the chains of injustice, get rid of exploitation in the workplace, free the oppressed, cancel debts. What I'm interested in seeing you do is sharing your food with the hungry, inviting the homeless, poor into your homes, putting clothes on the shivering ill-clad, being available to your own families. Do this, and the lights will turn on, and your lives will turn around at once. Your righteousness will pave your way. The God of glory will secure your passage. Then when you pray, God will answer. You'll call out for help, and I'll say, "Here I am." If you start helping people that need help, you just opened up a direct connection to the throne of God. When God sees that you're serious about helping others, watch what he'll do for you. For God is not mocked, for whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. If you sow a helping hand to others, God will help you when you need it. If you don't help others who need help, your prayers won't even get off the ground. Continuing on, Isaiah 58, verse 10. If you get rid of unfair practices, quit blaming victims, quit gossiping about other people's sins, if you're generous with the hungry and start giving yourselves to the down and out, your lives will begin to glow in the darkness. Your shadow lives will be bathed in sunlight. Oh, it's easy to blame victims, isn't it? We like to blame the victims so that we can excuse ourselves from helping them. Oh, they brought it upon themselves, we say. They dug their own grave. I don't need to help them because they brought it on their own heads. They should have known better. They should sleep in the bed they made. What if Yahweh had said that about us? What if he had told Adam and Eve, "You brought it upon yourselves. Sorry, but you'll have to deal with it yourself." What if God made the same lame excuses we do? No one would be saved. We all brought sin upon ourselves. God says, quit blaming the victims. If you do, your prayers aren't getting off the ground. And quit gossiping about other people's sins. Another version says, stop pointing your finger and spreading malicious rumors. That's the ministry of condemnation. And Satan is the head bishop of that ministry. If you gossip, let it die in your ears if you hear gossip. You know what happens when you repeat gossip, spread rumors about your brethren? Your prayers aren't going anywhere. Instead of wasting time gossiping, we should use that time to help the down and out. Now watch what God says he'll do if we help others. Isaiah 58, verses 11. I will always show you where to go. I'll give you a full life in the emptiness of places. Firm muscles, strong bones. You'll be like a well-watered garden, a gurgling spring that never runs dry. You'll use the old rubble of past lives to build anew. Rebuild the foundation from out of your past. You'll be known as those who can fix anything, restore old ruins, rebuild and renovate, make the community livable again. The sixth step of restoration is stop hurting others and start helping others. If you do this, the ruins will be restored, rebuilt. God will bring something beautiful out of the destruction of your life. And if you really want to take things to the next level, if you want to go even beyond restoration and take your life to an even higher plane, watch what God says. Verse 13. If you watch your step on the Sabbath and don't use my holy day for personal advantage, if you treat the Sabbath as a day of joy, God's holy day is a celebration. If you honor it by refusing business as usual, making money, running here and there, then you'll be free to enjoy God. Oh, I'll make you ride high and soar above it all. I'll make you feast on the inheritance of your ancestor Jacob. Yes, God says so. Too often, we treat the Sabbath as a holiday instead of a holy day. Well, I've got the Sabbath off, so I'll use that day to run my errands, go shopping, schedule my doctor's appointments, wash my car, clean the house, mow the lawn. If you want to soar on wings of eagles, then make Sabbath a God-centered day. Turn off the TV, the video games, and get out the Bible, other Christian books, or listen to some good Christian music. Enjoy quality time with your family. Enjoy your church family. Spend time out in nature. Lend someone a helping hand. Step number 7 is honor the Sabbath. If you honor the Sabbath, and that's the condition, if you honor the Sabbath, God promises you will soar on wings of eagles. You'll be so high that people will think you're on something, but you're not. You're filled with the joy of the Lord, and you will inherit the blessing of Jacob. Listen, your life may be in ruins today. You may have made a royal mess of your life. You may have let the enemy in, and now you can't seem to break free of the chains. When you think there's no more hope, then stop and listen. Listen for a voice speaking to the mountains.